Miss Farnborough, Reel 13.
And then in due course the prince would be sent to me.
Did you ever lose any that way?
Oh, hundreds and hundreds while I was developing them. I took them really at random because I couldn't say I took them only when they were interesting. I took them at all times because they were all interesting, even the most tragic ones, though I did have a sense of shame very often at photographing a battlefield which was still covered with the dying and dead bodies of our soldiers.
Did you have difficulty getting photographic supplies?
No, because the same liaison officer would always bring me some. And it was arranged by my friends that whenever I sent them back, I would send them back in the same box, same little box, all developed, only ready for, as negatives, only ready to print. And they would send me new boxes in return. I couldn't always carry, of course, the boxes round with me, nor could I even sometimes carry my camera, because there were opportunities when one just had to leave everything except one's hands. It was so critical to help those around us. But I knew that things would be safe. They all came together in a special fourmanka, a four-wheeled kind of cart, which carried our camp beds, our camp equipment, and anything and everything owned by the sisters. So I knew it was quite safe. And until the soldiers began to desert, there was no safer place to put anything that we valued or prized, because always our Tartar driver, a magnificent man, he would always follow up closely wherever we were being sent. And perhaps he was sometimes very late, and well, there are no camp beds for tonight. Good, we slept on the grass under a bridge, under a haystack, in a barn. And then perhaps they would arrive the next night, if there was a next night in the same position.
How did you pay for the developing and the photographic supplies?
Well, we were allowed 50 rubles per month. But I had money in Moscow. I don't know if I told you about that rather interesting thing, because before the World War, the First World War began, I had spoken to my Russian mother because I needed money now and then, although I was paid for being a companion to Asya and Nadia, but very, very little, and money didn't interest me, only when I wanted to buy something. And so I told her that I would get from my post office account in England £200 to be brought to the government savings bank in Moscow. And I remember her words. "Florence," she said, "you couldn't put it into a safer place. That could only collapse if the empire itself collapsed." And the empire collapsed. So that was the loss I saw of my £200. I still have the book showing me that the £200 is there in a государственный bank, in a state bank. But so, like many other things, I keep it as a souvenir of something that was and is not any longer.
I've talked to a lot of men and women who took care of English soldiers when they were wounded, nurses and stretcher bearers and so on. And they've told me that the men did not like to talk about the war and about the battles. But you said, I think, that the wounded soldiers insisted on telling you sometimes.
I think they had come straight from the front. The soldiers to whom you are referring might have been in hospital and perhaps long weeks from the first aid dressing stations, but ours were straight from the trenches, some of them not even bandaged, some of them coming in their blood-stained uniforms still, which we had to cut off and rip off them. But I can understand that all their thoughts were with their comrades and all their thoughts were still in the battle. So, you know, coming straight from there and seeing it all, as it were, in their mind's eye, you couldn't obliterate that scene. If perhaps after a few weeks they had been taken care of and sent away to a hospital, they would be thinking now more of the future, less of the tragic days that they had passed. And I think more than one soldier found great relief in telling me about what he had endured during those last hours in the trenches. There was one soldier I know who kept repeating everything that he had done, everything that he had said, and I could see he was happier. That taut, hard expression had disappeared from his face, and I knew quite well that he enjoyed and that he gained strength from telling me. And sometimes I would encourage him. I would say, you told me how you climbed over all those dead bodies of your comrades to reach the other trenches. Yes, he would say, and it would all begin again, as though he had not told me. And I encouraged it. I encouraged it to the best of my ability. But there were cases, too, of men who were actually dying and were still very anxious, more than anxious, to know how their comrades were faring in the trenches. I remember one especially, and he asked where were his regiment now. I could tell him we were attached to that special part of the division. And then he would ask me, are they still holding their own? They are still holding their own. The enemy have not advanced. The enemy have not advanced. And then he would just turn away and die.
I remember one of the dying men, you said, kept asking you what time it was.
Yes. Well, there was one who kept thinking that he knew he was going to die, and he would say, what time is it? And I would say, oh, the evening is drawing near. No, he said, it's getting very dark. I said, yes, night will come soon, the evening is drawing in. No, he said, it isn't that, it's that I'm going to die. They know. It's rather wonderful that they know, and perhaps a great blessing for them, because they become reconciled, especially those who are enduring great pain. Because before death there is that kind of comatose condition which soothes all pain. It's strange that I can talk like this, because I would have thought I would have been the last one to ever dream of seeing so many stages of death. But I really think, having been out there and for so long, and at all times, before, during, and after great battles, I really think I am well versed to recognize death in all its different aspects.
With so many wounded men in all different stages, did you find that you possibly had to ignore the men who were going to die to try to help the men that might live?
More than once, and it hurt incredibly. To me it would have seemed better if one had said, attend only to the dying, ease their last moments. But it was impossible, because we had to remember it might, those extra minutes thrown away, as it were, on a dying man, might be the causing the death of not one, but several others. And everything was done so quickly, at random. One had to rush from one to the other. It just depended where we were and how many were there, if others were coming, if it was a lull in the storm, so to speak, and we knew, well, we've got these 50 or 60 around us, we can attend to them carefully, you know, at our own time. But if we saw them crawling down the hills, coming up the roads, limping along, dragging themselves along, then we knew that work was there waiting for hours ahead, and there was no time, not a single minute to lose. But it hurt dreadfully, especially when they looked at you and expected you to do something to help, because you were there to help. And you just had to make some excuse and leave them.
Possibly, if you had done something to help, that would have only prolonged their agony.
It might. There is always that side of the tragic side of things. But we were told, if it is a helpless, useless work on a dying man, leave it. There are so many whose lives you can save by quick, definite work.
What about giving the water to the soldiers with the severe stomach wounds?
Oh no, that was not allowed. They weren't allowed to swallow any liquid whatsoever. You must understand, they couldn't, because the intestines had been cut and sewn together. Therefore, nothing must pass until the part that had been cut had healed. It needed 2 or 3 days for it. We were allowed to moisten their tongues, to moisten their lips, but never to allow it to pass through, because that would have been practically instant death, as it was in many cases.
Though if they were going to die, then having a bit of water would relieve their agony in the last moments.
Yes, I think I told you about that story of the man, didn't I? Who was dying, and he asked, begged for water, and his eyes followed me everywhere, because he knew not far from him was a man who could drink water, and there was a mug of water there, but he couldn't reach it. And he prayed so earnestly and was so completely intent on having something to drink that out of sheer weakness and pity I gave him some. But of course it brought about his death more quickly than had I not given him any. But I never regret, because after he had drunk, he looked at me with a tremendous look of gratitude in his eyes. And you know, he couldn't speak, but I knew he was grateful, and I knew that his passing would be eased, not nearly so painful, because he had got what he had craved for. It was wrong of me to disobey, but always I did it more than once. And always I felt it was the humanitarian thing to do when the case was hopeless. And there was no need to really define the hopelessness. One saw it. Death has a special mark that it leaves on a face. You know at once. We could almost tell how long it would be before they would go away from us on earth. And always I remembered this man especially, who was terribly ill after I had given him the water. All the water and all the terrible secretions within him in his stomach and intestines came up and practically choked him, but he was dead then. But I remember before that his look of gratitude, and that repaid me. As a matter of fact, it was that enormous look of gratitude in his eyes which so plainly, more plainly than words, told me that I had done the right thing.
Yes, I think so. Did you nurses or the doctors ever give anyone an injection or something to help them die?
Oh, but they were given that straight away. No sooner had they arrived than we gave them camphor for their hearts. We did everything to bolster up their strength. But I was never really very pleased about that, because there again, in many cases, it prolonged the agony. That, as the doctors told me, our mission here is to preserve human life, no matter in what stage of or condition the man may appear to us. If there is a spark of life left in him, we must do our best to preserve it. And so naturally, of course, we bolstered up the failing heart with injection after injection, and we injected morphia and everything possible against pain. So the injections were really a most essential, a most necessary part of our work.